Martinus and Alex, how's everything going, guys?
Great, great to see you, Jimmy. Yeah, it was fantastic meeting you in Cape Town recently.
Yeah, absolutely. And Alex, how's everything over where you are? I'm not even sure where you are, actually.
I'm in Indiana, Carmel, Indiana, outside of Indianapolis, but things are going very well. Very nice meeting you.
Yeah, great. I brought you two on the show because you guys are part of an organization doing stuff called Free Cities. So before we kind of get started on this topic, can you both give a brief overview of who you guys are to my audience?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're Martinus and Alex. We both work with Tiplet as well as the Free City Foundation. The Free City Foundation is working to develop what we call free cities, which are small jurisdictions or territories that are making innovative efforts in government to promote human prosperity and equity. And then Tiplet is a for-profit company that's actually trying to build these new cities.
Yes, yeah, and I'm Martinus Grobler. I live in Stellenbosch, a little country in the wine, or town in the winelands, just outside of Cape Town. I'm an architect by trade, and also joined Tiplet sort of from the start. Yes, under the founder, Titus Giebel, that sort of thought out this model.
Okay, well, so let's talk about the model a little bit, because you guys are pretty deep into it. But for a lot of my audience, like they haven't heard of what a free city is, and maybe they've heard of like Bitcoin Citadel, something like that. But really, they don't really have any idea. So what is a free city, and what's the main driver behind it, and what's sort of like the goal that you guys have?
Yeah, we think that free cities are the ultimate Bitcoin Citadel. Mm-hmm. The term free cities is a little bit broader, and it's a recently adopted term that we have to categorize all cities that are trying to develop something new and innovative that promotes human prosperity. But this term comes from the model we call free private city, which is explicitly developed by Titus Giebel, our founder. And the reason for the free private city is because he looked around the world as an entrepreneur that was active in Australia, Europe, US, and all of these jurisdictions were plagued by the exact same challenges. It was the local politics, no matter where you were, that always created uncertainty in the change in the rule of over time that made long-term investments in that low time reference focus much more difficult really to implement in the real world. And so Titus, since he's in his own right, as well as with legal background, developed a framework for how we might have cities operate that are not democratic, actually by for-profit companies that have a legal framework between the operator and the resident in any given city. And this has a few advantages that I'm sure we'll talk about throughout this conversation. But in particular, what it does is keeps your relationship to the governing provider very stable and explicitly outlined in that contract, which cannot be changed unilaterally by either party. So that's what I would say is the basics. Maybe Martinus has something to add.
Yeah, I think the important thing there is that the basis is that it's a voluntary contract. So that is that is really important. And I think if you just the concept of voluntary commitments is very powerful. I mean, we all there's this notion of that if you give people individual freedom, you end up with this individualism, which is completely wrong. The first thing people would do if individual freedom is to see that, wait a minute, they can get a lot more if they ally themselves to other groups, and they'll do that. And also through the model, you would be you can then be held accountable for your voluntary commitments through private dispute resolution that can be, you know, way more superior. And then you get these strong, very strong and resilient super organism of tennis club and church and school and family and everything. It doesn't mean everything in the free private city needs to be a fully libertarian setup. I mean, you can have maybe a good analogy would be nature. If you look at nature, nature is non-hierarchical, but it has a lot of structure. But there might be islands of very strong hierarchy, like maybe in a tribe of baboons or in some species. The same within a city where you can have. I'm a dictator to myself and I'm in the city, and you can have another bubbles of companies or family businesses or families that is as various degrees. But I think these are little bubbles, and how they interact with each other is on voluntary terms. And then you get these larger super organisms that that's really society is made out of, on that level, which is great. So it's the classic bottom up approach. The idea is to have a sound process and then, you know, to trust the process for the outcome.
Yeah. So if I understand correctly, basically what you're advocating for is instead of this sort of like, citizen government model, like these very large institutions, you have something much more local and, where you have, instead of a government per se, where you almost have no choice, you're basically born into wherever you're born into. This one is a voluntary contract where you get both sides kind of choose each other, and it's are obviously like no one is being held against their will or anything like that, and you can come and go as you please, but it's sort of like a practical implementation of anarcho-capitalism, if I'm reading correctly.
Yeah, certainly, I think that that's true. There's nothing inherent in the model inconsistent with anarcho-capitalism. It is a way to structure human powers that we think that, certain people would opt into, and it's therefore a good entrepreneurial opportunity. So, in general, the idea is to take, as mentioned, this relationship from being, top down, I rule you, I am the government and you must bow down to me, dear citizen. It's taking it to a more service provider and service receiver kind of relationship, like any other service on the market. You sign a contract, I will pay you X and you guarantee me Y. If the terms are breached by either one of us, then we can have it resolved in an independent dispute resolution that neither one of us controls.
Yeah, and that's kind of pretty attractive, obviously, for numerous reasons. And if you have sort of like selection mechanisms on both sides, where the people that like seek out these things will tend to demand certain things, and then the people on the other side that are governing, they're not going to just accept anybody. And that should, at least in theory, bring a lot of people together. What I found interesting in your book, by the way, the book, why don't you introduce the book real quick, the one that gave me the Free Cities and Bitcoin one.
Yeah,
what that's about.
Absolutely. Yeah. So that's my book called Strategies for Liberty, Cities and Bitcoin. And the book is really supposed to give a very basic background on both this model of free private cities as well as Bitcoin, and how these things are actually not just the best strategies for liberty for humankind, but they're actually very collaborative. Bitcoiners should support free private cities, free private cities should support, use, and implement Bitcoin in their cities and promote their cities.
And it goes through a lot of part one does goes through a lot of like how things would work and so on. But what I found interesting was that the argument basically that there have been a lot of different jurisdictions that are kind of like free cities or are a step towards free cities. You give examples like Hong Kong, Singapore, Monaco. Can you tell us a little bit more about like how those places work and what sort of processes and ways of working that you would take from those, and you know, like what have we learned from those examples, and what are some things that that you're looking to make with these free private cities that you guys are working on?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a fair amount to learn from both those existing case studies that you mentioned, as well as historic studies as well. It's not that there's ever been a perfect implementation of the free private city, but there are analogous cases that there's at least, you know, some basis on which to learn about who and why these jurisdictions are successful, and how we can apply that to our case. So I would say Monaco is really a sort of interesting one in the sense that it's a monarchy, and it has really devoted itself to being attractive for expats and super high net wealth individuals. And the way they've done this is really through having that long-term monarchical focus that is catering and effectively treating all residents of Monaco as service recipients. You have a similar story in Liechtenstein, where actually Prince Hans III wrote the book The State in the Millennium. And he advocated for a model that it's not exactly a free private city, but nonetheless, to boil the book down to a short sentence, the point is that states need to adopt and start treating their citizens as customers in the future. That will be the way the nation state must evolve. And so I think there's something to learn from that as well. You know, Singapore and Hong Kong are similar in the sense that Singapore is a sovereign country. Nonetheless, it is able to provide for its own defense. It is very entrepreneurial focused. It is a world-class banking sector. It's done a lot of great policies to encourage entrepreneurship, innovation, and strong property rights. And then Hong Kong, of course, is an interesting one in the sense that it is sovereign, but not completely. It has its own autonomies and is its own story of relationship with China these days. But nonetheless, it shows how Hong Kong, even with other China, by separating the legal system, by implementing the British common law legal system, you can see why the success of Hong Kong is so much higher than of China. And Tina, you probably have a ton of comments to make on this too.
No, I think you covered the best ones. If you go back into history, there's also obviously a lot of things. I think one thing that's worth mentioning is just the scale of things. The whole idea of the nation state is a relatively new experiment and a complete failure, and that obviously accelerated with the sort of unholy alliance between banks and states. Yeah, that culminated in a lot of trouble. Also, that very contributed to the Hanseatic League's end, you know, which was a great model, which is, so there's something to say that it's a decentralized model. So you'll have a lot of different things.
Describe the Hanseatic League, because I don't know if my audience necessarily knows that much about it.
Okay, so that is that was sort of a league that started, I think, from the 1300s, as a it was a very pragmatic thing, and they throughout Europe. So that time in Europe, Europe was broken up in a lot of sort of little authoritarian pieces, although decentralized. So, but eventually, it was sort of a black market that eventually, through trade, became formalized. And eventually they had a lot of clout, and they were able to raise their own armies, build their own cities and marketplaces and et cetera. But it started, I think, more with, and you can correct me, Alex, but I think it started more with sort of shipping law and the trades and, you know, because you have to cross country, get into contracts. So to create sort of a law system that was adapted and they were far-reaching, so they had this way of trusting each other. Yeah. Portugal to Russia almost, but mostly concentrated in the north of Germany and the north of Europe, yes.
So cities like Nuremberg, Rorschach, even London at certain times, it's really those northern German cities that created the Hanseatic League. And it's important to remember that at the time, this is the time of the Holy Roman Empire, and these cities were able to basically say, sure, we will be part of the Holy Roman Empire, but we are going to negotiate. We want to have some ability to have autonomy of our own. And in particular, they wanted that autonomy so that they could trade and be entrepreneurs. And they knew that was what brought wealth to their city. So they then formed the network of all of these cities where there was some uniform way of having contracts promoted, even common currency. Certain cities became known as the place where dispute resolution would go to, because they were known to have fair and just arbitration, these sorts of things. And so it really is a dynamic example of how order would emerge in the market, even amongst competing entities. There's a reason to work together and create this network of trade, because it leads to.
Yeah, and this is an important point, because I think for a lot of people, they think the nation state is sort of like the default way of doing things. One of the things I appreciated about reading about the Hanseatic League, and really a lot of history is like that, where you had a lot of smaller, states that sort of allied with each other. You bring up a really good example of the Holy Roman Empire. The joke is that it wasn't holy, it wasn't Roman, and it wasn't an empire, but it was a whole bunch of little sort of city states within northern Germany, or what we now call Germany. Really, what that yeah. The entire country didn't exist. Similar with Italy, right? Like, it was a bunch of city states, and you can go even further back to ancient Greece and stuff like that. Those were all little city states. So this model of free cities, of smaller jurisdictions, is actually like way more normal historically than we're led to believe. We're led to believe like it's all giant, empires or something like that. When in fact, this is much more the normal way that people related and to their government, with smaller states and local rulers and things like that. And that seems to be what you guys are aiming to do here.
I think that's exactly right. And interestingly, a new topic of study in my end is really the rise and the downfall of city states. And it's maybe a little bit too reductionist, but nonetheless, it's a good first approximation to say that many city states that once existed and prospered are no longer in existence, and therefore no longer prosper, because they can become empires. They grew so big. They became more aggressive, defensive. They first printed money, or their version of counterfeit currency. So those really are the downfalls to a city state. And it's interesting how they intend to do this geographic expansion when it's actually not necessarily for prosperity. There's a scale at which certain services need to be provided, maybe like dispute resolution and security. We think that is sort of at the city level. But these other services, like defense and trade, really actually don't require nation state at all. The smaller the jurisdiction, the more they're going to be to trade, because they can't develop, make everything only. And trade, of course, defense could be through alliances with different nation states. I mean, not that I advocate for it, but NATO right now is just exactly that. It's a bunch of nation states joining together to supposedly provide defense. So that's really what we advocate for, is that a certain scale, it's the city scale, for certain governments, but there's no reason to need it to be a nation state and massive territory resources for any reason.
Well, so let's talk about sort of like modern sort of experiments on this. And one of the things I found very interesting was the proliferation of special economic zones, which you talked about in the book. And that as you argue in the book, the first ones were really popular. But now just about everyone has them. There's almost like too many. The market is kind of glutted with them. Can you tell us a little bit more about the history of special economic zones and, you know, why they were popular at the beginning and how they've sort of like fizzled out almost as, you know, they proliferated and just about everyone has them now?
I think one of the one of the first ones was that one in Ireland, right, where they where back in the day they flew from London over the Atlantic, and but they couldn't make it there to top up for fuel in Ireland. And I forgot the name of the little town. And after they could fly further, then that wasn't needed anymore. And they decided, okay, let's we have all of this little town and people's livelihoods, so let's do the experiment of an economic zone. And that actually worked quite well. And then, you know, the model sort of copied from there. But I'm sure in principle it might have been even in antiquity. I'm not sure, but that's sort of a modern example, one of the first ones, I would say.
Yeah, well, I do think it existed certainly throughout history in some way, shape, or form. But really, the book and sort of the modern version, as I would argue, these sort of started in China in Shenzhen in 1980 or so. And this really started with Deng Xiaoping realizing that people didn't invest in communist China. They didn't want to invest in it because they felt like their investments would be expropriated. And so let's create a different legal framework, have some local authority to make them more innovative and adaptive. And it was a wild success. Now, there are a lot of studies on this and a lot of reasons for the success. And all of the social economic ones are always successful. And Shenzhen's location relative to Hong Kong is important. But nonetheless, Shenzhen stands out as an example of how wildly successful these can be. As you mentioned, other countries saw the success with these models. They tried to import them into their own country. And what we see now is that about 150 countries around the globe have special economic zones. There's about 6,000 special economic zones, of course, some defunct and smaller, and really quite large and operational. But 6,000 is quite a lot. 150 countries is just about every country that's not the United States or Western Europe. And it's why they're trying to attract investment into their countries, and that's the best way to do it. The challenge really is it is difficult to move global supply chains around on a whim. We've learned that the whole COVID experience, that at the margin, if you are, say, you know, El Salvador, and you create a special economic system that is on par with Honduras, businesses already aren't going to move to El Salvador because you have given them a similar framework. Their logistics already in place. It would have a lot, there's a lot of fixed costs that would have to be eaten out to move every bit of that supply chain or the new manufacturing plant or whatever. And so these special economic zones are no longer, you know, 6,000 in one is not going to change the dynamics of the market. So what we are is that it is that standard special economic zones won't do that. But you take it to the next level, you give them more autonomy, you give them the ability to be run by a private partner, including on the regulatory and governance front, that those would be innovative enough and long-term oriented enough to set up policies and procedures to attract these companies over the long term and make the investment worthwhile. So that's how the story that we tell. We think it's true that there's a trend towards more autonomy in these economic zones.
But they weren't necessarily, you know, some of them were born in, you know, out of sin in any way as further interventions. So by sometimes a country would build or a state would build a harbor because they think politically it can give them votes in that region, and they do it with other people's money. And then they realize, okay, it's a white elephant. It doesn't, it can't make it turn any profit because of course it wouldn't if it, otherwise the, if the market would have, you know, seen to that, that it would have been supported. Then for further intervention is needed, and then they create these zones around it, trying to attract people with all kinds of, you know, tax reductions, etc. So it's, yeah, but it's a, it's almost an admission from their side as well that you can't do business in the normal environment. You need these special zones to operate. So, which is quite funny.
Yeah, but what you said was really important, because you can have like similar things, but there are enough switching costs that you need to give them a better deal for a lot of these companies to move over. And you know, at this point, pretty much everybody, like you said, has some sort of special economic zone. So what is the next level? And I think you mentioned one in Honduras. I think it's like called the ZED. I don't know what that stands for. But what's the difference between that and a special economic zone? And, you know, what, you know, how has that sort of played in the market so far?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So what exists in Honduras now are called ZEDES, Z-E-D-E. And this stands for Economic Development and Employment. What happened was that some folks in Honduras realized that the country was extremely corrupt and that that was inhibiting their ability to develop economically. They looked at Hong Kong, saw the wild success that that city had, and they wanted to create the homeland of the Caribbean. But they knew that Honduras was coming all the way up to the Supreme Court. And so what they needed to do was carve in some part of their territory and set it subject to laws and regulations. In Honduras, they were actually able to change the constitutional framework, largely through luck and happenstance, as well as a lot of blood, sweat, and tears. But nonetheless, the constitutional framework was adjusted to allow for these zones. And what these zones do is, typically the special economic zones were like, we want textile manufacturing. And so we're going to create the best framework for textile manufacturing. Well, it's good to have lower taxes and more market regulations. I don't deny that. But that's still something bad. That's still something we textile manufacturing here. Mm-hmm. And what the ZEDES would say, well, we want to take even a bigger step back. We don't the right industry, we don't know the right companies, we don't know the right entrepreneurs. What we want to do is set a framework to have a sort of local government with a private operator, a promoter, that is taking a risk and subject to profit and loss mechanisms in the market. And we want them to create the laws and regulations and try to attract industries that would be successful to these. And so they have a couple of ZEDES that now exist, and wildly different the two that exist is interesting in its own right. Prospera is the first one and sort of best known. It exists on a Caribbean island to the north of Honduras, still part of Honduras. And they've really focused on trying to be innovative in terms of property rights, 3D property rights, very advanced manufacturing technology. They have, it was just there this weekend, they have a bunch of folks that are interested in longevity down and various gene therapies and things that would be illegal in the United States because of the FDA. They're getting done in Prosper. So that's a very interesting case. The other one that exists in the mainland, right outside of San Pedro Sula, which is the industrial capital of Honduras. It's called Ciudad Morazan. And what they've focused on is being extremely efficient with how they build and provide profitable but cheap housing that is safe from the gangs and cartels in the sort of greater region of San Pedro Sula. And they've done that for a while. So in fact, it's the most populated of the cities currently to develop. Even with challenges going on with the government of Honduras, they're developing more residential housing because demand is very high. And just to put it in perspective, they're able to develop these units for people to live in because they don't have extraneous zoning and building regulations. They can profitably rent those students out for $120 per month. Think about that. Yeah, you know, in the US, it's a 10x per apartment.
Wow. All right. So you have these ZAs. How many? Like the thing for me about all of these special economic zones, ZAs and stuff is sort of like the long term credibility, right? And this is where, you know, people would rather do business in Hong Kong or Singapore versus, like, say, a special economic zone that Kenya just set up, because you don't know if it's going to be around. And this seems to be the problem with Honduras as well. They're, I guess, maybe starting to take them away, or there's a new leadership. What's generally the strategy to get long-term credibility on these? And I imagine you guys are running into this as well. It's, okay, we want to set up a free city. Huh. Like, no one's going to move there if, like, 5 years from now, like, just, you know, the regime changes, they take your charter away or something. And, you know, like, what's the strategy for long-term credibility, I guess?
One thing would be, to get people moving there, it's how do you create this living organism? It's almost how do you create a rhinoceros? So you have to do a lot of sort of living transplants as well. There's, you know, if people want to move there, they want to move there with their families, and there needs to be schools, etc. So one thing in that also is that it's not just for foreigners. It is mostly for locals. So local people would move only a few kilometers or miles in, you know, to there. And you can also use some of the host nations institutions and as sort of a soft landing at the start. But getting the first 100 people, 1,000 people there might be quite difficult. But then you can start building out your own institutions, your own idea of school, your own idea of health and food, etc. And you can conceptually reconstruct them, because now you can do it in an environment where there's low time preference, there's regulation, the regulatory environment is different, it's on a sound jurisdiction, and there's better price discovery because of better free economics, etc. So soon these institutions would be superior, and that's sort of the idea that it'll grow, and also that it'll be supported by locals, and that they would prefer it. Not that it's competition to the host nation in a certain sense, yes, but if you have this wealth creating node inside your country, it's really beneficial for everyone. So that's one strategy, the local strategy, and also to have it as diverse as possible. It's not just digital nomads or not just manufacturing, etc. And then another strategy that I can think of would be the bless you the the decentralization of it and the network of it. So maybe in a region there might be a few ones. One might be more smaller and more concentrated on education or tertiary education, or another one manufacturing, etc. And then you have this regional network between them, and even later a network of international cities. And some of this network might even extend to organizations in other countries that incorporate there, like maybe some exchanges need to incorporate there just in that jurisdiction and start experimenting with those jurisdictions just for their own safety, because people are after them. Everyone in the freedom movement, from media companies, etc., you know, it might not be a bad idea for them to start experimenting with these jurisdiction and even investing in them for their own sake. But anyway, another thing, Alex, that you might say is how Prospera are defending themselves. Yeah.
Yes, I think you hit on a few of the key things. So I guess I would say at the outright that we're living in this physical world. There is no elegant solution like Bitcoin that is anti-fragile and doesn't need anyone's support. Yeah, it will keep going. Free cities are more challenging. Are in the physical world, and they require entrepreneurial funding, blood, tears, innovative thinking. Absolutely. So you don't want to sit there to be perfect and flawless. Challenges, of course. The things you can do to protect these sorts of cities would be obviously strategic perspective, having multiple locations. So then, of course, you've invested a bunch of capital in one location, but if you have multiple locations, then anytime someone, you know, a dictator comes in and wants to exploit your land, you immediately call resident for future capital expenditures to the different city, which at least is a distance. You, of course, want to give locals a lot of jobs so that they support what you're doing. This actually happened in Paris 40 years ago with the original Special Economic Zones. The next government was elected and wanted to get rid of them. But it turns out that those Special Economic Zones had companies that employed something like 30 or 40,000 Hondurans, which is a big voting block that no longer could a politician think about getting rid of them without really sacrificing their ability to get elected. You want to have people's living, and then there's the line for opportunity and resources. So those are positive ways in which you might align interests. There's also the sort of negative side that you have all investments that are in one of these three cities are made from a company that is in a different host nation. And that host nation has multilateral investor protection treaties with the host nation. So for any disputes made under this bilateral or multilateral treaty, the seat of the host nation is not in the host nation where the free city lives. And this is what's happening with Prospera. They were starting to incorporate Paris Prospera Inc. in the United States. All investments made under Prospera Inc. into Prospera City are subject to the CAFTA Dominican Republic Agreement, so Central American Free Trade and Dominican Republic Agreement. This agreement is extremely robust. There's been billions and billions of dollars of investments that have been made under the and the dispute, the seat of dispute resolution is in Washington, D.C. So it's not like you're going to go to a banana republic and go to a court where you're going to be up against it. It's going to be resolved in the United States. Now, this is 100% of the problem because a court outside of the U.S. could decide that the U.S. is guilty and award the winnings to Honduras Prospera Inc. But how do you collect it? And this is another challenging thing. Potentially, there's a role for Bitcoin in this as we move into the future. But right now, how it's doing is that assets outside of the U.S. are seized and sold, ultimately to pay back the numbers over a long period of time. So it's a perfect solution. It's an ugly solution. It's making relations with Honduras difficult at the moment. But it's ultimately that form of protection that is required to make billions and billions of dollars of investment. It needs to be protected, you know, subject to these sorts of disputes. And it seems to be holding for what it's working in Honduras right now. It's been 2 years of a post president being elected. She ran on the campaign of getting rid of these headaches, and she has not been able to, hasn't even appeared to be trying explicitly. She's putting pressure on them, making the banks a little nervous and working with these sorts of things, but has done absolutely nothing in terms of expropriating property, aiding, anything like this. It doesn't seem likely that she will. It seems like in 2 years, the next election will sort of butter along, and then we'll see what happens in the next election. So it seems to be holding more place.
Well, so we've been talking about all of these different zones and so on. Where are you guys on the project? And, you know, what candidates do you have for free cities? From a very practical perspective, for a lot of people listening to this show, you know, what possibilities are there for this sort of thing? Because, you know, they might be thinking, oh, you know, this sounds kind of good. I don't know if I like the jurisdiction I'm in. I'd like to have more freedom, maybe more like-minded people, better governance system, more privacy, stuff like that. What are you guys working on, and what are some, you know, jurisdictions that you're looking into, and how far along are you?
Sure. Yeah. So obviously Honduras is the furthest along. It's really the sort of OG project in the space. Our founder, Titus Diabol, was the chief legal officer of Prospera when it started. He stepped away from Prospera because he wanted to create Tipless, and he wanted to do this in as many new jurisdictions as possible. He saw the need to have a network of these working together to support each other. And so that's what we've been doing. I can tell you, the discussions we're having with governments are increasingly interesting. Governments are increasingly willing to bring autonomy. Kind of perversely, COVID to have made hosting very receptive to our proposals, given their dire financial situations. So we are having discussions. Now, I don't think what this did, but I can tell you sort of broadly, Latin America, the Caribbean, and Africa are all very, very hot. I would say, you know, maybe even the majority of countries in these places are open to these discussions. Doesn't mean we're involved, but we're certainly talking with groups in all of those regions and finding increased receptiveness. Other regions are on the outskirts of Europe, even in the U.S., getting very tricky with our jurisdiction arbitrage in the U.S. And then even over in Indiana, there are a few aspects that all the movements. Tini, anything?
No, not really, at the risk of saying too much. but there has been some MOU signed with a few, right? And hopefully soon with a handful, yeah.
Yeah, unfortunately, well, so let's talk about these is that they're very confidential while you're negotiating with a government. And once you can go live, you do want as much publicity as possible. But it's not a stake. They're so easy to attack politically that if we have discussion, we'd like to have discussions leading up to elections. But if it leaks out to the public, it's very quickly something that position can latch onto, and
let me ask it this way then, instead of like what you're working on, what's sort of like the ideal that you guys hope to achieve, and then, you know, what would that look like? How would you know, Bitcoiners like establish themselves in one of these places? Would it be like a citadel? Like, is that like a close approximation? What's the ideal there, or what are you guys trying to achieve? And yeah, instead of telling me about the actual processes, which seem to be fairly confidential, tell me more about like where your vision is.
Yeah, so I would say by 2035, so in 11 or so years, we would like to have 3 to 5 of these cities set up and growing with actual people living in them and working together as a form of network, actually. Mm-hmm. So each one would have different population metrics, and some of them might be a bit more exclusive, and, you know, islands and smaller places that don't have a bunch of space but want to attract a certain clientele. But then others can be, like most countries, they have really in plenty of space. And so those cities can grow as big as you want, the manufacturing and industrial capacity that you want. So I think by 2035, you know, we'd like to have 300,000 or 400,000 residents in 75 cities, with businesses in every single sector. And we'd like to have a very strong Bitcoin focus. In particular, I think it would be fun to think about one of the models that we look at. The Dubai International Financial Center. It's been wild success, but it's very traditional fiat money. I'd like something similar for Bitcoiners, make it sort of the Bitcoin financial center of the world. Even things about like a new form of corporation, like a Bitcoin. You know, TBD on the details, but I think that those are the sort of things that we're trying to focus on. And Bitcoiners are obviously a top marketing customer.
For me, I would say that the we're living like fish out of water, even more and more so these days. I mean, if you look at kids can't walk to school, if you look at our food, our health, our education, everything is sort of debased, as you would say in your book. And there is even one of your nice lines in your book is, what do you say? Your dreams have been this debased, yeah. Which is so, you know, and it's so true. So it's for me, you know, one approach would be, so we fish out of water. So now let's just strap a virtual reality thing on this fish and he'll be fine and grow him some legs and put him in a little car. But I would like to build, you know, build a little lake for him to go back into. Not saying that we should go back like Luddites or whatever, but I think our whole human nature and psyche sort of co-developed with the idea of living in smaller tribes, in, you know, much more human interaction, etc. And in a sense, those villages were the true smart cities. Just because of the flow of information, you just walked two steps across the street and there was a lot of little diverse shops. There was a lot of division of labor closely connected to each other. And, you know, obviously that can be put on steroids and taken to the next level with Bitcoin and true price discovery if you really put it on sound money as well. So then to create these real smart cities like they were in villages in the old days, and who knows what together with new technology, I mean, that can really be a nice multiplier. And these things are really multipliers if you take, you know, just virgin land and some extra jurisdiction and Bitcoin and price discovery and the ideal way of how a new school can look and education can look, etc. You end up with a massive potential.
Well, so great vision. Obviously, I think a lot of Bitcoiners are interested. How much interest, I guess, have you had? How many people have like put money towards this? Like what sort of like the, I guess like not just talk, but like actual, you know, money put towards this, or Bitcoin put towards this, because it sounds interesting and it's a great vision. And I think a lot of people would love to have a community where, you know, mm-hmm. you're not getting debased food and you have like community, and it's, you know, it's closer to, you know, like getting out of like the fiat world, I think, like very physically speaking, would be very attractive. Like how much interest have you had so far? And not just like people signing up for an email, but like actual like money put towards it.
Yeah. Not enough, but growing up, I would say, first of all, we are in a sort of emerging market where there aren't new companies trying to do something like that. There are, believe it or not, competitors of ours, and on a handful. Each one, I mean, this is really broad, you know, call it 2 to 50 million. With Crosstalk, actually a little bit more because they do have physical land. They do have some operation up and running already. I think they've raised maybe up to 150 million or something like that for Crosstalk. So that's what we're talking in terms of invest now. We are, I guess, Bitcoiners are a segment of our investors. It is hard to get Bitcoiners to part with their Bitcoin, especially as it's growing up, especially pre-halving. I get all of it, and it's unreal to promise a return above what Bitcoin is, whatever, 4-year run, it's just something like that. So it takes a little bit of ideological support, investing to see the world, see for maximum returns. But we are getting our mouth to, and we're finding a lot of support. Same with real estate. That industry is also relatively receptive to what we're trying to do. So I think there is, now we're to tens of millions. But when Tipple is a project running, I think there's reason to believe that, you know, hundreds of millions, even up to the billions, could be on the table at the right time. Doesn't mean it'll be easy. Doesn't mean that it's readily accessible or anything like that. But that there is enough in these ideas that if you find the right partnership, you find the right people, there's enough trust, there's enough support amongst the Bitcoin and real estate, and to some degree, old crowd as well, for investing in things like this. Mm.
All right. Well, that's encouraging, and certainly, I think as you know, governments get more authoritarian, we'll see a lot more of this stuff. And you know, I'm glad you guys are doing it. The book is Strategies for Liberty, Free Cities and Bitcoin. Good read. And you know, it gives you sort of like the practical aspects of what a Bitcoin Citadel might look like. And I think it's definitely worth reading. Where can people find you guys? Where can they contact you and find out more about these things and keep up with the progress with all of these, you know, memorandums of understandings and things like that, that you're getting? And yeah, where can people follow all of that?
Excellent. So you can get the book on Amazon. For more about Free City, the sort of movement and the philosophy, you can go to free-cities.org. And then to keep up with Tipolis and our dealings in the real world, go to tipolis.com, T-I-P-L-I.com. See any other links?
Tell us your like Twitter handles and stuff, right?
Okay.
Yeah, sure. Twitter at edboss12. I am there mostly just posting more than anything else that we tweet original content, but you can find me there.
I have a Twitter handle, but I, for the life of me, can't remember what it was. I'm very inactive on it. I'm on LinkedIn, Martinez Grobler, M-A-R-T-H-I-N-U-S, G-R-O-B-L-E-R. And also, yeah, so you can reach out to me there if you have any questions.
Okay. Well, I'm super excited about the project. And I think as we go more away from a fiat standard and more towards a Bitcoin standard, you know, projects like yours will become very important, because we're really like kind of looking for different models of governance that work for us. And it's funny because I just remembered that the thing that you guys are talking about, where jurisdictions are competing for citizens, is something that I talked about in one of the books I wrote a while ago, the Little Bitcoin book. It's cool to see it coming to reality as Bitcoin takes more of a center stage. Anyway, thank you guys. It was great.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Jimmy.
All right. Unchained Capital is a sponsor of this podcast. I'm an advisor to the company. I know the team well, and I'm excited for what they are building. If you need multi-sig, collaborative custody, or a Bitcoin-native financial services partner, learn more at unchained.com.